All right, welcome to session 111, Why Do Women Fight Against Their Own Interests? Please turn off your cell phones, noisemakers, you know the routine. All right. Georgia Platts holds a PhD in sociology from UCLA and currently teaches sociology and women's studies at Buffalo College. She has a blog, Broad Blog, and is also a Ms. Blogger. Georgia lives in San Jose with her husband, Rob, and her cat, Felix. In her spare time, she volunteers with the anti-poverty group Results.
Hello there. So, women fighting against their own interests. This is something I was very curious about as a child. I grew up in the 70s when the women's movement was getting going and the church was in backlash against it. And as a result of that, for example, I went to my piano lessons with my piano teacher was from my state. And after my piano lesson, my mom and my piano teacher would talk for maybe half an hour about how horrible those feminists are. And my piano teacher was really, really upset about some feminists who wanted to get some battered women's shelters going. And I'm like, why doesn't she want battered women's shelters? This makes no sense to me. And I asked my mom about it, and my mom couldn't figure it out either. She says, well, maybe they don't like battered women's shelters because the feminists aren't qualified to run them. I don't know. It didn't make any sense to her. But, you know, I grew up later, you know, when I grew up and I learned more about the history of this, I discovered that people who were against feminism, they didn't want any intrusions into patriarchy at all, even if men are beating up their wives. Don't want it. And so, but I was like, what? Why is this woman fighting against, you know, battered women's shelters? When I got older, so I was kind of young at this time, I'm about 10, but I found out that some of the older women were on orders to pack a lunch, get in a bus, go to the women's conferences that were trying to support things like the Equal Rights Amendment, and vote everything down. You know, equal pay for equal work? No. Anything that was going to help women, we don't want it. And I'm like, what is going on with this? I don't understand it. Within Mormonism itself, with the priesthood, a lot of women, even today, still don't want priesthood. You know, you've got, Sunstone had some statistics on this. They talked about how nearly half of men are okay with female clergy, 48%. But only 10% of women favored women having priesthood. And, you know, I'm like, what's with this? And then there were just certain things where people, they just didn't really complain. So in the 70s, in my ward, I don't know if this was everywhere, but in my ward, women were told you can no longer give the prayer in sacrament meeting. And in activity night, girls were told you have to wear dresses. And so it was no more activities anymore, you know, because there wasn't a lot. You couldn't play basketball and that sort of thing in a dress. And it was, every lesson was temple marriage. And, you know, no one really complained about it. Everyone was pretty complacent. So I started, you know, just from this background, wondering why is it that we have these women who are either not complaining or who are actually fighting to keep the status quo with them having less rights than men have. Why is it that they're doing this to themselves? Why are they doing this for their daughters? Why are they doing this to me? I didn't get it. And, of course, it's not just Mormon women who fight against their interests. You know, if you go back to 19th century, women trying to get the vote, the suffragettes, you would think women would be all excited. Yeah, we want to vote. And, you know, I teach women's studies. My students are always so surprised to find out that women at large, initially, weren't all excited about getting the vote, and that they would sometimes ostracize women who were fighting for that. They would ridicule them. You know, so, well, this is strange. Even today, women who are feminists, well, the word feminism can be called the F word sometimes, you know. And, you know, let's see, I have students who have defended women, men who have battered and raped women. Maybe some of you remember the Chris Brown and Rihanna incident from a few years ago where Chris Brown really beat the crap out of Rihanna. And then Oprah had a show on it, and there were women who were defending Chris Brown. and I've talked about it in my classes, and generally the girls don't like what's happened, but some of them have told me they've talked with their sisters, and their sister was defending Chris Brown. Well, Rihanna shouldn't have done this. Like, okay. Or rape. I still have students who, women students, including women students also, who say, well, sometimes women just bring it on themselves. I had a student, I thought this was very strange, she was talking about a woman who, well, she was wearing a nightgown, so of course she, you know, she was on campus wearing a nightgown, so of course she wanted to be raped, and I'm not, I can't even imagine the scenario, but it's like there's something wrong with this woman if she's walking around campus in her nightgown or something, you know, but she was telling me, no, she wanted it, that's why she was wearing a nightgown when she was walking around campus, you know, but you just get these sorts of things, or I was reading the New York Times, and in Egypt, you have women who, I guess it's kind of a widespread thing, there will be a report in the newspaper that a woman is killed by her lover, and most Egyptian women blame the woman rather than the man who killed her. A few years ago, Karen Hughes in the Bush administration went to Saudi Arabia. She was talking about women getting the vote and women driving. And the Saudi women were saying, we don't want that. We don't want to vote. We don't want to drive. You know? Things like female genital mutilation, where the clitoris is either removed or everything, the inner and outer labia, everything is removed and stitched up. And the women are the ones who actually perform the ritual. My students will say, well, why is it that the women are performing the ritual? You know, why are they doing this? It causes pain for the girls. It's traumatizing for them. They live their lives in pain. Of course, they have no sexual pleasure either. But if you don't have antibiotics, about one-third of the girls die. You know, a lot of them end up crippled. And so the question is, well, why is it that women are the ones who are performing the ritual and keeping it going? Okay. Well, I also learned that it's not just women who do this. Sometimes men also will fight against their own interests, or at least not work to try to change things. I asked my students, can you think of examples of people, you know, not just women, but maybe in cultures where people will either acquiesce or fight against their own interests? And I will have students from India who will say, well, in the Hindu caste system, everyone pretty much just keeps their place no matter where they are. You know, you're an untouchable. And you're considered so polluted that no one even wants to go inside to your shadow, you know. And just the stigma that creates for someone, but they go along with it. Or there's the term Uncle Tom, you know, meaning an African American who's working against his or her interests. Karl Marx coined the term false consciousness to describe workers who didn't really get that their interests weren't being served by the status quo and just went along with it. Okay, so I've got all these questions. What is going on? Why is it that people generally, and my focus on women largely because of my background in Mormonism, why do they fight against their own interests so much? And so I got into graduate school in sociology, and I finally started to understand what was happening. There's a variety of things that are happening. One of the most important is that a child is born. And when a child is born, they don't know anything. And the world just seems very, very chaotic. And they have to know how to cope. How do I get through the world? And so what happens is, unconsciously, the brain starts noticing patterns. Oh, men, let's take the 50s just to do a real simple example. Say you're a little baby born in 1950. And you start noticing as you grow up, oh, men are the ones who go to work. Oh, okay, men do that. Women are the ones who stay home with their kids. Oh, okay, that's what women do. You can do it with race, too. Oh, black people, you're watching TV, they're the criminals. You know, because that's what you tend to see on television in terms of the roles that they're playing. Or they do the menial jobs, you know, those sorts of things. So you start classifying the world, and your brain is doing this unconsciously. It's actually the source of our stereotypes, taking a complex world, simplifying everything. Okay? So what happens is we just go, oh, okay, that's how the world is. And maybe we question something every now and then, and you ask your parents, and your parents are well socialized into this too, and so they just explain, oh, that's just how things are, and you go, oh, okay, that's how things are. But what happens is, so this is called internalization. Internalization is when society, the way society thinks, is now in your mind. Okay, so it exists there. and you just take for granted. You simply take for granted this is the way the world is. And as I said, I was born in the 60s, and so I was growing up during the women's movement, but before I ever heard of the women's movement, I remember saying to my brother, it's no fair. You have all these different kinds of jobs you can have, and I only get to be a teacher, a secretary, or a nurse. I only have three choices. And see, in my mind at that time, I don't know, maybe I was 8 years old, it just never occurred to me. I thought it was unfair. I wanted to have more choices. But it never even occurred to me that I could do something different. That's just how the world was. And so what you get is just automatic thinking. People, they're just on autopilot. They go through the world, and they don't know anything else. That's just how the world is. They've never heard anything else. So you look at the cultures that practice female genital mutilation, and they're born into a culture where that's what they're told they have to do. They're told they have to do this to girls in order for them to be pure. And no one ever questions it. And so typically what happens is people just take for granted the world as it is, unless they happen to hear some divergent voices. So if you have a cultural clash, for example, and cultures come into contact with each other that do things in different ways, suddenly people might say, wait, there's other ways to do things? So you see this in some of the cultures that practice female genital mutilation. They're starting to come into contact with other cultures that don't do it this way. Something that still keeps the practice going is God. That's a huge influence. If you believe that God wants you to behave in a particular way, it's very common for people to say, well, I want to be a good, righteous person. I don't want to be punished by God. And then you'll turn off any diverse voices you hear. You know, so in Mormonism, if you believe that God wants men to have priesthood and not women, you're just going to shut out voices that say otherwise. So with female genital mutilation, people think it's in the Quran. This is practiced in North Africa, the Muslim areas of North Africa and parts of the Middle East. And they think it's in the Quran, but it's not. So it really helps to try to explain this to them. But a lot of times they're uneducated, they can't read the Quran. But if they come to understand that it's not in there, they're more likely to let the practice go. But, you know, typically, anytime people think that it's just natural and right, it tends to keep going. Another thing with women in particular, we've kind of sexualized male dominance in our culture. So, you know, people talk about it in pornography. Most people, you know, aren't growing up with pornography, but there's a lot of male dominance in that. But our culture, generally speaking, you'll see ads. You know, just you're walking down, you see a billboard, and there'll be an ad with a man who's kind of lording it over a woman. I show my students lots of pictures that show male dominance in ads, and I didn't bring any of them with me. But, you know, romance novels, The Bodice Ripper, where the lover, he can't resist, and he rips the bodice off of the woman, you know, and takes her. Well, this is enacting male dominance and is sexualizing it, eroticizing it. And so this is another thing that tends to keep something like male dominance in place because it's become so eroticized in our culture. Another thing with women that's different from maybe ethnic groups is that women's husbands, lovers, children, you know, half of their children typically, one of their parents, for about 95% of women, their lovers, their husbands, you know, are going to be men. And so women are fearful of offending men. And it's interesting that when you live in a culture that's sexist and it just seems natural and taken for granted, men often won't feel bad about doing sexist things, largely because it just seems very natural and secondhand and, you know, just feels kind of natural and normal to everyone. But then if a woman complains about it, then she's the bad guy, so to speak. You know, and so women are often worried about offending men. But these are some of the things that will keep it in place. Just the taken for granted. You don't know anything else. You don't think to question things. The sexualization, fear of offending men. Those are the main things that play in women's minds. I also wanted to mention women who are who go against the mold. Not everyone just fits in perfectly with this world. There are ways that you can move out of it. As I said, one is to hear diverse voices. Women in the Middle East, They're starting to have satellite TV, the internet. They're starting to learn that women do things differently outside, and so that's starting to make them think a little bit. Although, as I said, if you have a really strong belief that God wants things the way they are, that will often stop you, right? So that's one way that you can start to change things. Another way is there are certain people who just have very different experiences and personalities that kind of come together that move them out. So looking at, for example, Susan B. Anthony. So Susan B. Anthony led the women's movement in the 19th century. And you look at her experience, it's very different from your typical woman in America. So Susan B. Anthony was born into a Quaker family, and the Quakers were very unique. They believed that women and men were equal. And her father felt it was very important that she be independent, be able to take care of herself, and he trained her to be that way. He also made sure she got into a school where there were boys, not just a girls' school where you're learning to put a book on your head and walk with good posture and where all the forks go and all that sort of thing, but to get a good education that was equivalent to what boys get. She also had a very activist personality. People who studied Susan B. Anthony said she had to put her energies into something. And so you mix that personality with her unique experience of having much more of a sense of equality, independence, those sorts of things that came together in her. Her partner, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, her partner in the feminist movement, Susan B. Anthony wrote, tended to speak the speeches, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton tended to write them. Okay, so that's how the partnership worked. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton also had an unusual upbringing compared to most women. In the first place, so she was, there were like 8 daughters in his family and 1 son. And she talked about how the son was more valued than all the daughters combined. In this society, women were thought of lesser than, and all of her father's hopes were for the son and what the son would be able to do. And then he died. And so in the first place, she always wished that her father loved her as much as the son. And after the son died, Elizabeth Cady Stanton wanted to be able to take his place and to fulfill her father's dreams. But that simply wasn't really a possibility in that culture. But her father, at the same time, he made sure she got an education that was very good. She went to a school with boys, so she got a good education. Another thing is that her father was a judge, and she would hear the judge and attorneys talking about legal matters, and so she would get ideas into her head about things. But more importantly, women would come who had been wronged, and she was very upset by the things they would say. There was a woman who was married to a drunken man who was constantly drunk, beating her up, and she wanted to leave, but in order for her to leave, she would have to give up custody of her children to him, and she would have to give up all of her property. And so she's begging the judge, please, please, let me, you know, keep my children and my property. And the judge kept saying, it's in the books. I'm sorry, the law is in the books. And when Elizabeth Cady Stanton was 10 years old, she went up to one of these women, like this woman, and she said, don't worry, I'm going to find the law in the book, and I'm going to cut it out, and then it won't be there anymore. Okay? She's just going to get her scissors out and cut it out. And there's several laws that she'd heard about, and she had actually circled them in pencil. And she thought, I'm just going to destroy these, and then women will be okay. They're not going to have these problems. Okay, well, she grew up and realized she couldn't do that. But it made her want to go to law school. Her father wouldn't allow her to go to law school. But, you know, she had this background, so that she had a very unique background compared with other women. And very, you know, empathetic and touched in her heart by the problems that she'd seen women deal with who came to her home. So sometimes you have people who move out of these taken-for-granted ways of seeing because they have really quite unique experiences. Looking at my own experience in the Mormon Church, what I noticed with the backlash is that it seemed to be actually pretty effective with most of my friends. Most of my friends just kind of towed the party line and said, you know, okay, yeah, I'm just going to be a good, you know, Molly Mormon and get along. And I didn't. I'm not entirely sure why I was different from them. I suppose I have a little bit different personality in some ways. I care a lot about equality. A little competitive with my brother. It really bugged the heck out of me when my brother turned 12. My little brother turns 12 and he gets the priesthood and I don't have it. Well, another thing, my parents were divorced. And my mother and me and my brother, my little brother, moved in with my grandmother. And so here you have a family, grandma, mom, me, and my brother. And after my brother got the priesthood, my mom says, well, now that you have the priesthood, you're the head of the family. What? My little brother's the head of me? Are you kidding me? You know, and I have sibling rivalry with him anyway, so I was not happy at all about that. I mean, I kind of went into a bit of a rage, okay? So so maybe I had a little bit of a unique experience in some of those ways. But interestingly, I think that the Mormon Church actually turned me into a feminist. I don't think I would be the big feminist that I am, except for having grown up in this church. And so it's odd. In some ways, I'm a little bit grateful for it because it brought me to my calling in life. I teach women's studies. As she mentioned, I am a blogger. I have a feminist blog, and I blog with Ms. Magazine. So it's been something that has actually put me into my place of passion, but as I often say, at great cost to women at large. So I feel that that's unfortunate. So the ways that you can change, number one, people with different experiences and personalities. Number two, being able to hear these voices and not just go, okay, God just wants it this way, so it has to be this way. I have to be lesser than, you know, questioning that. Also, just moving out of what's called automatic thinking into controlled thinking, being critical, thinking about things. Some of you may have heard of, Harvard has a website, and they're trying to look at implicit attitudes. And what they do is, so maybe it's on racism, maybe it's on sexism, different areas. And so you go to the website, and maybe you choose the section on racism. And first they will give you a survey, and they'll ask you, how racist are you? And so you'll fill that out, and most people think they're not very racist. And then they have you do this exercise where you have to do it so quickly that your brain doesn't have time to critique what you're doing. This is just your natural way of thinking. And so looking at the issue of race, what they'll do first is they'll show a white person's face. If you see a white person's face, you hit the E on your computer. And if you see a black person's face, you hit the I on your computer. Okay? Then what they do is they have words, either positive or negative words. Successful, you hit the E on your computer. Unsuccessful, hit the I. Criminal, hit the I. Things like this, okay? And then what they do is they have it paired, and it'll say, if you see something that is either white or good, hit the E. If you see something that's either black or bad, hit the I. Okay, so people do this. And then they switch it, and it says, if you see something either white or bad, hit the E. If you see something that's either black or good, hit the I. And so what happens, suddenly people start going slower. They start screwing up. They'll see the word criminal, and instead of hitting bad on this side, they'll hit black on that side. Okay? And so what this is showing is that it gets to people's real attitudes, the taken for granted ones, the ones that they haven't had time to critique, and you know, and so what they found is that while most people think they're not racist, most Americans end up, there's different categories. You can be, let me think what they are, strongly favor whites, moderately favor whites, slightly favor whites, no bias, slightly favor blacks, moderately favor blacks, or strongly favor blacks. And most Americans end up in moderately favor whites. And actually, most blacks, too. About half of black people who take this get into moderately favor whites. And this comes from living in a culture where white is so often associated with good, and black is so often associated with bad, criminal, those sorts of things. And they're just these unconscious processes that happen. You know, so you have your causes of racism, sexism, all these sorts of things. And some people, not everyone ends up at moderately favor white. Some people move around. Some people end up unbiased. I guess because of my background, I score better than most on this exam. I actually move around. I have scored on moderately favor blacks, but I've also scored moderately favor whites. And the truth is, most of the time, I end up at slightly favor whites. Okay, so that suggests that all of my racism isn't completely gone, but I do have a lot of flexibility. When people do women in science, most people have a strong preference for thinking of men as scientists. I, even though I'm a feminist and I've worked a lot trying to overcome, I do better than most Americans. I end up with a slight preference for thinking of men as scientists. But all of my sexism isn't completely gone. And the way that you do get rid of it is you have to be very careful to critique, to be aware of things. If it's something like racism, it can be really helpful to be very mindful of people like Nelson Mandela and Toni Morrison and Maya Angelou, Barack Obama, people who you admire, people who where you see that they are very bright, intelligent people. Those sorts of things can help you. But so basically what I've been trying to tell you about is how we come to taken for granted ways of understanding the world where society comes into our minds. We just see the world the way society does and ways to get out of it. So I was wondering, does anyone have any questions or comments?
If you do, can you come up so the recorder can pick it up?
Where do you want me to
stand? The poll's fine, I think.
especially, you're from San Jose now?
Yeah.
Can you talk, you talked about female genital mutilation, but there was that in the news in the last few weeks about San Francisco and what basically sounds like male genital mutilation or circumcision.
Okay.
And can you talk about that? Would that be okay?
Okay, well, I just wanted to ask you, when you say that, are you talking about male circumcision?
I am.
Okay, and the differences between the two?
Yeah, and whether that plays in. I just feel like maybe it would help, you know, we talk about the female, but maybe if we flip it, that would be helpful, eliminating what your subject is.
Okay. On that one, there are some differences between the two, some really important differences. One is that, okay, there's similarities and differences. Here's the similarity, is that males don't have any say over it. You know, it's just done to them. And a lot of males aren't too happy about that. Okay, they've done studies to try and, well, studies, they've interviewed people who have been, maybe they've grown up uncircumcised and then they get circumcised. And they've asked them, do you notice any difference in pleasure? And some men say they don't really notice any difference in pleasure whether they're circumcised or not. Some do. I'll have to say it's easier to masturbate if you are uncircumcised. Okay, that's like the main difference in terms of how, where they know there's a big difference in circumcised and uncircumcised men. So the main difference between the two is that the men don't have, or the main similarities between female and male circumcision are that men don't have a choice when it's done typically, and there is some concern that it might lessen pleasure a little bit, but as I said, people who've tried to look into this are unclear as to whether it makes a difference or not. With girls, it's different in that it is, the whole point of it is to try to remove girls' pleasure. When men are circumcised, they can still really enjoy sex. You know, most men, you know, don't have any problem having orgasms. But with women, the whole point of it is to get rid of women's pleasure. Now, another thing with circumcision, there's actually one thing that's good about it, and that's that you're less likely to transmit AIDS. And so in Africa, they are wanting to use circumcision more to try and stop the transmission of AIDS because the virus gets into the fold and it's easier to survive there. So there's actually one positive thing. With female circumcision, there's no positive thing at all. Women will lose their pleasure. And for the more severe forms, they're going to be in pain. They're going to live their lives in pain. Sex is going to be painful for them. They're more likely to get the AIDS virus when they're circumcised as opposed to men being less likely to at least transmit it. And as I said, 1/3 of girls die. So that's a big difference. I mean, you look at a circumcised male, on his wedding night, he's still probably going to enjoy sex a lot. If you have a girl who's been circumcised in the most, the strongest form of it, what happens is her husband will cut her open with a knife, so blood and pain right there, and then intercourse is going to be not pleasurable for her, you know. So they're very different. Some people want to call it female genital cutting or circumcision, as though it's the same for women as for men, and it's not. It is considered a human rights abuse because of the number of girls who die, the number of girls who end up being crippled. You have girls who constantly leak urine and they smell, and so they get ostracized from their communities. It's a much worse procedure when it happens to girls than to boys. You want to follow up?
Yeah. I certainly wasn't trying to equate them. Mm-hmm. I guess I was trying to say this idea of looking at things that we assume to be okay, and this idea in San Francisco, from what I gather from the news, and I'm further removed in Colorado than you are in San Jose, is that idea that it's not, the argument seemed to be that it's not a medical procedure. We do it without...
There's only one reason, and that's to prevent AIDS transmission.
Well, it's interesting that San Francisco, of all places, would be the place.
Yeah,
where
you would think you might want to be.
Anyway, so that's that idea of unspoken kind of assumptions that we make the argument when we're talking about feminism, and then I wonder, if it would be valuable to talk about.
If men don't want to be circumcised, it's fine with me. I don't. If it's important to them, I don't really care. If you're in Africa where you have huge problems with AIDS transmission, I think maybe it would be a good idea to educate people on it to try and stop, because it seems like it might be really helpful in that case.
Going back to where it even originated, Jewish culture, is like we're assuming.
Right.
Could there have been at that time some hygiene reason for them? I mean, infection,
I really
other kinds of things.
For female circumcision?
No, for males.
Oh, yeah, maybe. I don't know.
I'm just saying...
You could be right.
Besides AIDS, there might have been some other hygiene reasons why it actually came about. Does that make sense?
Maybe. And also, if you read the Bible, they don't like masturbation real well. And as I said, it helps to have that foreskin.
My understanding of the way that FMG, female genital mutilation, is practiced in Africa is it tends to be in former Arabic areas. Now, the Arabs themselves, it was an Arabic custom. Right, they're Muslim.
The North Africa and parts of the Middle East, it's actually probably more of a black custom, an ancient custom before Muslims moved down.
You think so?
Mm-hmm.
I understood that it was originally an Arabic custom, although the Arabs don't do it anymore. But it seems like there's this trade-off between veiling, and so when they start veiling, putting women in purdah, which you can't do until you've reached a certain level of wealth, then they stop doing the cutting. Mm-hmm. But my understanding, at least from reading about the way it's practiced in Tanzania, is that it's sort of, it guarantees you're a virgin. People don't even care if you've had sex or not as long as you're infibulated, which is the extreme form of genital mutilation. So,
well, it's really hard to, if you're all sewn up and you just have teeny, enough room for urine and menses to pass through.
Right, and in Kenya, among the Maasai, they won't even let, the husbands won't let the wives be cut open when they're giving birth, which is, and so the women starve themselves so they have a tiny little baby.
Oh, my gosh.
But I think it's this concern about female chastity, and the women are willing to put up with it because then they don't have to be guarded and
Well, that's not really what's going on. It's like, would you rather wear a burqa or be mutilated? I'll put a burqa on,
Yeah. Well, they don't have any choice.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. They don't have any choice. Mm-hmm. I don't think it occurred to them to cover women that way, in these cultures. They're just like, okay, we want to make sure that girls are sexually pure, so let's make them so that they won't get sexually aroused. And that can be just nicking the clitoris or removing it or taking everything and sewing her up so that she physically can't have sex, But, I was in a class one time. I was actually sitting in on a class. And the instructor was saying, this is just a cultural practice, and we need to just accept everyone's culture. And I said, well, who created this culture? You know, did the women have equal power to create this culture that's going to kill about a third of them, you know, and cause the rest of them to be in pain and crippled and these sorts of things, you know? I have problems with relative morality when you have one group of people that has greater power and they force their power on a weaker group of people for their own benefit, whether it's slavery. You know, you're exploiting a group of people. Blacks didn't have equal power in creating slave culture, you know. Unlike when we were trying to get rid of slavery and the Southerners were saying, you Northerners, stay out of our business. You know, this is none of your business, right? And as though, you know, this is just our culture. Well, blacks didn't have equal power in creating that culture, you know. And you have one group that's exploiting another. And with female genital mutilation, you have men who want to make sure their children are theirs. And so they're going to make sure that that happens for their own benefit, you know, and they're going to make women suffer because of it. You know, I have a problem when that's what's going on. Yeah.
Would you talk a little bit about the possibility of women getting the priesthood and what you see as good signs or bad signs and how you see that happening?
Yeah, good question. With 10% of women saying they're open to it, I mean, my own experience when I actually did go to church was I even felt really like I shouldn't say anything. I was really afraid of being ostracized. And I've had friends who have spoken and they're ostracized. And so after a while, I just quit going to church. But yeah, the thing is that women, you know, okay, I was visiting my mom. And my mom was saying she wanted someone to... They're talking about who to put in Relief Society. And my mom wanted, or to be a teacher, I guess it was. Who do they want to be a teacher? And my mom thought this one woman was a great teacher. And another woman said, well, we can't have her because she believes women should have priesthood. You know? And so there's so much ostracism that women are really, really fearful to say anything. And so I consider that a real problem. And I find it very interesting. I'm not entirely sure why it is that men are so much more open to it. Maybe they don't feel like they're betraying the church as much. I'm not sure why that is. But I think when you live in a culture where people are afraid to say anything or to think things, that it's going to be really difficult in the culture to keep, to get women to have priesthood. And so many women like me, they just leave, you know. So, and I have a good friend who really was trying to stay in the church and fight, and I wasn't interested in staying that much, and she was trying to keep me in, and now she's out too. You know, she just gave up. Because you just get so much, you get so punished for speaking, and people know that they do, so they keep their mouth shut. And I think what happens is, if you look at people who are drawn to churches like Mormonism, they tend to be people who like black and white. And God is all-knowing, and the church is perfect. And so it draws people who are like that. And then the people who stay, that tends to be their mentality. People who don't like that sort of thing leave. And even if you look at the churches that attract new members, it tends to be the more conservative churches that are more black and white, more authoritarian, that tend to bring new members in. And I'm sure the Mormon church knows this. And so I think that that's going to make them less likely to want to give women priesthood, because the people who join churches are the very most conservative people. So I'm not real optimistic that Mormonism is going to change on that front anytime soon. The only way it would be if the culture changes so much that women's minds generally really change, is my thought on that. Yes?
Comment about two things. One is male circumcision, at least in the Judeo-Christian era, started when Abraham believed the Lord commanded him to do it, and they did it for everybody, you know, until we had Christianity, and then they said they didn't have to do it.
Anyway. Right.
You didn't say anything about the trial that's been going on down in Texas, San Angelo, this is Warren Jeffs.
Oh, Warren Jeffs trial.
Yeah. Okay. There you have mothers taking their 12-year-old daughters be married to this lecherous old man, basically, and women seem to buy into that, you know, that it's, I mean, it it's got to be that they've grown up in this, what you described, this culture they grew up with. That's the way to do it. It's right.
Fair. One of my blog posts is called "Are Women Brainwashed into Polygamy?" Okay, and I look at one of the women who left and her talking about the culture that she grew up in southern Utah, and I talk about how, in a way, we're all brainwashed, you know. So they're just more brainwashed than most because they're so cut off from the rest of the world. You know, so here you have these girls, and they never, their television's discouraged, movies are discouraged, anything that comes from the outside is discouraged, they're not well educated, you marry them very young, get them having babies, you know, if you have a really young girl that gets married, that's going to disempower her even more, she's less likely to have any further opportunities for education, and they're constantly told, you know, you'll be damned. It's just hellfire if you don't do this, and you'll be rewarded if you do. And so some of the girls who have left talk about how fearful they were when they left, that they were like, well, I'm going to go be damned to hell, but, you know, I'm going to do it anyway. They're definitely going through the same process that I was describing, but it's actually much more intense because they don't hear any alternate voices. But on that point, it's something I've always been curious about with Mormon women. My feeling on polygamy, when I realized that if I was the best person I could possibly be, my eternal reward was going to be a polygamous wife. I'm like, what's my motivation here to be good? You know, I mean, it sounded more like hell than heaven to me. Okay, so I find it interesting that Mormon women just go along with it. I mean, that was actually one of the things that made me hope that the church wasn't true. Okay? Because I'm like, I don't want this. It's like, this is going to be my reward. No, thank you. I was really fearful of it. Yeah, okay. Follow up.
My very unscientific survey and observation about Mormon women are they do buy into that they don't get the priesthood. That they don't want it, generally, they say. It makes sense. But they don't buy polygamy.
Yeah, they don't like it real well.
No, they don't.
Growing up, I would hear Mormon women talk about not liking it, you know, and do you think you could share your husband and not liking it and being stressed out by that, you know? But just kind of keeping with things. But I was just like, this is horrible. You know, this does not sound like a reward to me. Maybe it did to Joseph Smith. Maybe it does to a lot of men. I don't get what the appeal is to women, though. you've been waiting, right?
There is one issue that I think we can separate from religious bias, and that's women voting against or opposing economic equality, equal pay for equal work. And I'm wondering if you could address that issue and how, in terms of your topic, why do women, in some cases, actually vote against the prospect of equal pay for equal work?
Yeah, well, my thought on that is that's what they've been told they're supposed to do. You know, you grow up in a culture where, you know, I talked to my mom about it, and because my mom was against it too, even though she was a single mom. This is the very strange thing about it. So I said, Mom, I don't understand. Shouldn't women get equal pay for equal work? This was in the 70s. And she says, well, it's not really fair because a man has a family to support. So she was just taking the status quo answer. A man has a family to support. Now, she's a single mother. She had a family to support, too, you know, so she wasn't really thinking about it. And so it goes back to what I was saying about how if you grow up in a culture where that's all you know is that men are supposed to make more money and then they give you the excuses, well, men, they have to support families and women are just doing it for extra money, so they don't need as much. You know, I remember hearing that when I was growing up. And some people will buy it. You know, they'll just go, oh, yeah, I guess that's right. They were uncritical about it. You know, it's just that society, the way you've grown up into a world where that's all you hear or that's what your religious leaders are teaching you and that's what God wants. And for most people, if they feel like that's what God wants, that's what they're going to do because they want to be in God's good graces. You know, that's what your religious leaders are telling you, you know, so all the Mormon women who would pack their lunches and go off to the women's conferences and vote down equal pay for equal work, they thought they were doing God's work, you know, because their religious leaders were telling them to do it. Just really unthinking. You're next, I think.
Sorry. I'm a former domestic violence counselor, and you know, whether you know it or not, Utah has one of the highest domestic violence rates in the entire nation. I mean, it's
stunning. Okay.
Okay.
You have to...
I'll speak over here.
Yeah,
like a
question.
I'm a former domestic violence counselor in Arizona.
Right.
And many of you may not know this, but Utah has the highest, or one of the highest, domestic violence rates in the entire nation. I mean, you'd be stunned. Utah County is stacked. And I'm just, I guess, asking from a guy's perspective, what can men do in addition to what we know to empower women? I mean, obviously, you know, women have their own perspectives, but what, you know, what can we do? You know, we don't
think
like women.
It's important to have
so.
Men as partners in changing things. Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because if you look worldwide, the more patriarchal the culture, the higher your levels of domestic violence are. So if you look at the Cherokee and the Iroquois before Europeans came, or like soon after, because this is where you get the records from, the Europeans come over and there's no domestic violence. And they're like, what? You know, they're so surprised. There's no rape, or virtually no rape. And they're so surprised by this. So they're writing about it and how shocked they are. But this is, there's a debate whether it's an egalitarian culture or a matriarchal culture, but there's at least a lot of equality between women and men. Property is passed through women, but property is not that important to these people either, okay? The bloodline goes through the woman, because people have sex with whoever they want, and no one knows who dad is, okay? So, you know, women have their own tribal councils, men have their own tribal councils, women have control of the corn. So if the men in their tribal council decide we want to go to war, and the women in their tribal council say we don't want them to, and then they meet together, and the men say we want to go to war, and the women say, well, we're not going to give you any corn then. Okay? So so you have a lot of equality in this culture. And women are respected. Okay? And you have a lot of equality. Now you go to a more patriarchal culture like Vietnam, and some small villages in Vietnam were studied, and they found that there was domestic violence in at least half of the homes, somewhere between half to every single home in this highly patriarchal culture. In the United States, as patriarchy has decreased, domestic violence has gone down. If you look at domestic violence rates in the early 1990s, we're down 65%. Now, compared to the early 1990s, and it's partly because of hotlines, battered women's shelters, you know, women learning that they don't have to put up with it. My mom had a friend who, she just thought everyone was beaten up when she was in, this is in the 1970s, before anyone talked about it. She just thought that was life. Her mom was beaten up, she was beaten up, that's how the world is. She's watching Phil Donahue, and they have a thing on domestic violence, and she's like, what, this is unusual? So she left her husband, no longer beaten up. Okay, so part of it is education, but the main thing that you can do is to help men to respect women, to be more feminist, to have, as you make the culture more feminist, men don't beat their wives. As men respect women, the more men respect women, the less they beat up women, the less they rape women. And if you look at rape, men often rape women because they're actually, there's a type of, they have different motivations. There's one type of rapist called a Walter Mitty rapist. And this comes from a Broadway play. So Broadway play, you've got this Walter Mitty, and he's just this little kind of a weakling guy, and he's got delusions of grandeur. Okay, so he's always trying to bridge the gap between who he is, this little weakling, and who he thinks he should be. And there's this something called a Walter Mitty rapist. And this is someone who feels very powerless. But he has notions of what manhood is. Men are supposed to be strong, dominant, aggressive, violent, potent. And when he rapes, he experiences himself in this way. He feels himself, experiences himself as empowered. Okay, so looking at your ideas of manhood, when your ideas of manhood are all these negative ways, you're more likely to get things like rape and wife battering. Another thing that happens with men when they get depressed, men aren't supposed to have any emotions other than strong or, you know, or anger, emotions other than anger. They're supposed to be strong, and they're one of the few acceptable emotions for them to express is anger. And so when a man is depressed, okay, a woman's depressed, she's more likely to go to psychiatrist. But man is depressed, he's supposed to be strong, so he's not supposed to be vulnerable and go seek medical attention, you know, from a psychiatrist. And so what he does sometimes when he gets depressed is he will change the depression into the emotion of anger. And so part of the problem for men is not allowing them to express their full feelings. And also, when he's depressed, he's often feeling powerless, and he beats up his wife, and he feels powerful. You know, so it's all tied into these ideas of what men are. So if you start to change your notions that men and women are equal, men don't have to prove that they're superior, they can have a wider range of emotions. They don't always have to feel like I'm strong and I can't see a psychiatrist, you know. So supporting men to have to express their full humanity, to respect women, those, you know, are ways to help to combat and just increasing the worth of women in society. Yeah.
I was doing a little research on the church's involvement in the Equal Rights Amendment. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could mention some of the best resources, articles, books, that kind of thing that that have researched the involvement of church leadership and high-profile church members in opposing feminist movements in past decades and today.
If you've studied it, you would probably be better at that than me, because that hasn't actually been one of my areas of study. You know, I've been aware of things, but I have never done any real strong research in Mormonism on that issue. Yeah.
I came in a little bit late. Did you touch on at all on the slut parade in Salt Lake City?
Yeah, what are they called? The slut walks?
Slut walks.
Yeah, okay, so...
And is that in women's best interest? Are they working in their best interest?
Okay, yeah, and there's a debate about that in the feminist community. Okay, so what you find is that people who are put down, they'll often take the word and make it their own, right? So you've got queer, and you've got people who are gay taking on queer. You know, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy was a show a while back, you know. In the African-American community, you have people using the N-word, and with women, the B-word, and now this slut word, okay? So you have all this. Now there's a debate. So if you look at any of these communities, I say other than the queer community, they're okay with using that word pretty much. I haven't heard any debate that we shouldn't use that word. But within the African-American community and the feminist community, there's debate about whether you should, how helpful it is to embrace the word. Because what happens is it still ends up hurting you, because context is so important to language. A word isn't just a word. How is the word used? You know, you take a word, great. And how do you say great? You say, that's great. Or you say, that's great. It means opposite thing, right? And so the way you use any word and how it's understood is going to depend on context. So you have women who want to take the word slut back and say this word can't hurt me, but I suspect that so long as you use the word in a negative way, it's probably still going to hurt. I mean, you have African Americans and they've tried to embrace the N-word, but I can't use it. You know, they don't. It hasn't changed enough so that they say, yeah, I'm fine with it if you use it. You know, I can't use it, they can. So I have my doubts as to how effective it would be just because a word isn't just a word. It depends on how you use it. I think it will continue to maintain the connotations that it has. That's just a guess. But, I mean, they can try, I guess.
I just wanted to clarify, what exactly was the slut walk? Okay. I think I understood, but some people were asking.
Oh, okay. I think this was in Toronto. A woman was raped, and I believe it was a judge or a police officer, can't remember, someone in authority, said, well, what do they expect? Look how they're dressed. And women were tired of getting, saying that is her fault because of how she's dressed. And so women decided to dress in their sluttiest clothes and walk around and take the word, you know, so the slut walk. And so it starts there, and then different parts of the United States, you have it again. So that's the point, is to try and take the word back. Yeah?
Just one clarification. There were people dressed in slutty clothes. There were also very well-dressed women in a variety of costumes.
Oh, okay. So they had variety. So some people came slutty and others didn't.
Well, yeah. Okay. Of course. It was the same message, doesn't matter.
Right, okay, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that it can raise consciousness, you know, it can get the conversation going. So I think it can be good that way, just because there's so many people who don't get it. So just to get the conversation out there can be helpful, I think. I'm not sure how well it's going to work in terms of taking the word back.
But don't you think that that would be healthy if you were a victim to see this response to that?
Yeah, you're right. I think that would be helpful. Because, you know, rape victims so often feel guilty. It's one of the few crimes in which the victim feels guilt, worries, what did I do, you know? Yeah.
I took an introductory anthropology class a while back, and they talked about matriarchal societies and patriarchal and all these others. And a point that kind of struck me is that even in the matriarchal societies, there are still men kind of behind the scenes controlling what the women may be doing. And it made me think that, could you talk about maybe the biological wired brains of men and women, and why our world seems wired towards this patriarchy, and you know what's underneath all of that that seems to be preventing equality that we think should
well,
be true?
I mean, I would have to look at what you looked at where they show the men in the background, because I've seen societies where there don't seem to be any men in the background. You know, like I was mentioning with the Cherokee and the Iroquois. I don't see any men working things in the background. It seems to be very egalitarian in that culture. So it's in those cultures. On the eastern seaboard of the United States, Tahiti is another area, some parts of the South Pacific Islands. So you have some areas where you don't have patriarchy. If you look at, we don't know what caused patriarchy. We have a few theories. One theory is... start to notice that kids are healthier if, okay, say you have a tribe that attacks another tribe and they bring new blood in. And those children are going to be healthier, the kids that are not inbreeding, right? So they start to notice, oh, it's healthier, we have stronger kids if we don't inbreed. So what they end up doing is they either buy or exchange or steal women, okay? So the question is, why is it that they decide to buy or steal or exchange women rather than men? And since we don't have a lot of time, I won't ask you your ideas on that like I do with my class. But the reason seems to be that, number one, if you want to have a bigger tribe and a stronger tribe, you're going to want women. If you've got 100 men and you add 100 men to your tribe, you're still going to have the same number of kids. But if you add 100 women and you have the polygamous wives, then you're going to have a lot more kids, okay? Now, another thing is that women are smaller than men, and so they're easier to control. There's concerns that you bring men in, they're going to be harder to control. Men, because their job tend to be more hunting, and that they would have gone farther afield than women, understand the terrain better, be able to escape more easily. So for all these reasons, they bring women in. Now, what happens to women when suddenly you're buying and stealing and exchanging women? They become property. You start to think of women as property. And the women that you bring in are at the low, they don't have any people of power to protect them. They don't have powerful family members. You know, so this could be a cause of patriarchy. Another thing has to do with, we're running out of time, agriculture. When agriculture comes, a lot of these cultures seem to be egalitarian until agriculture comes into being. And you have excess wealth, and so some families become more powerful than other families. But because women's role tended to be with children, and men's role tended to be more with trade and warrior, the men were more in the political areas. And so men being in the political areas of trade and you know, small contracts, you might say, and political treaties with war, men tended to end up in the... A family would get more powerful, but it would be the man who would be more powerful because he's the one who's been in the political realm. And then once men are in the political realm, they start making laws. Women can't own property and all these sorts of things. They see the world from their perspective. So those are a couple theories, just real quick, on why they think patriarchy came about. So we're out of time, I believe.
Yes, we are.
Okay, well, thank you.